From New York Public Radio, this is On the Media. On the Media is produced by WNYC and heard across America on NPR stations. This podcast is made possible by WNYC and its listeners. Support your local public radio station. Visit onthemedia.org to find where On the Media is playing near you. And please help support this free service by becoming a member of WNYC at WNYC.org. WNYC On Demand is supported by Open from American Express, presenting the interactive webcast event, Making a Name for Yourself. Kate and Andy Spade and Bobby Brown discuss their leap from business to brand, created by Open from American Express. Registration at openforumonline.com.
From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Mark Jerkowitz, Associate Director of the Project for Excellence in Journalism, sitting in for Bob Garfield. When President Bush and his Iranian counterpart, Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, finally took to the UN rostrum on Tuesday, confrontation was in the air. But what might have once played as a battle royale, this bout had more of the tone of a warm-up match. A warm-up for something much larger. Time magazine reported this week that the Pentagon is actively reviewing war plans, and with the International Atomic Energy Agency disputing the threat assessments coming out of Washington, the skirmish also has the eerie tone of something all too familiar. This week, reporters John Walcott and Warren Strobel of McClatchy Newspapers reported that some intelligence officials fear a replay of the mistakes in the lead-up to the Iraq War. I asked Strobel if journalists were feeling deja vu as well.
I think the answer is yes. The colleagues that I have talked to and myself and my editors at McClatchy, there is a little bit of a sense of here we go again. And I think there's a determination this time to be a little bit more aggressive, to be a little bit more suspicious about what the administration says, to be a little bit more questioning about where they are headed.
One of my theories about what happened in the run-up to Iraq was that there was a sense all along that there was an inevitability to this war, and that quickly media organizations got into this, let's get ready to cover a war, you know, mode, rather than really spending much time investigating the rationale for the war. Do you get a sense among fellow journalists and people you talk to at this point that the same dynamic is occurring, or is there much more question in people's minds about whether this will ultimately lead to a military conflict?
You know, I think you make a really good point. I remember distinctly in October of 2002, I was sent with many of my colleagues to a place in Virginia to do some battlefield training kind of stuff. And just virtually every news organization was doing the same kind of thing for its reporters. As you say, we were all getting ready to cover a war that had a sense of inevitability about it. I have to wonder whether it's going to be different this time. Let's say the Bush administration does start doing more overt things that look like they're going to attack Iran. I have a feeling and a fear that the news media will do what it sort of has to do by its institutional nature, which is to just gear up to cover another conflict.
This week, Time magazine was the beneficiary of a leak having to do with naval planning for a possible war in Iraq. It was a dramatic story. It involved orders to ships and minesweepers to prepare to deploy. There was a sense that something might happen in October. Did anything about these leaks strike you as unusual?
Let me say, for starters, we had heard actually somewhat the same thing that Time magazine reported this week. We didn't put it in our article because we only had it from one source and we didn't feel like it was confirmed, but they seemed to have it pretty solidly. I thought it was, a little unusual that that kind of military planning would leak, because from the perspective of certainly the White House and even of military officers, it kind of looks like it would be helping the enemy, right? You're telling them what the U.S. is doing in advance. But I think it's probably an indicator of the degree to which people in uniformed military and elsewhere in the administration are wary this time of where the administration is going.
You and your colleague Jonathan Landay have been widely praised by press critics for being among the very few mainstream news reporters who did report on the debate within the intelligence community in the lead-up to the war with Iraq, who were able to find voices who disagreed with the administration's position on WMD. What did you do that your peers weren't able to do?
I think it's very easily explained. What we did is we made a conscious or at least semi-conscious decision that we were going to put faith in what the professional diplomats, military officers, and intelligence analysts were saying more than what the administration was saying. people at the middle levels of government, what my boss John Walcott calls the blue-collar sources. I think without naming names, what most of the other media did was to put most of the emphasis on what Rice and Rumsfeld and Cheney and Bush were saying, and then in the 10th or 8th paragraph of a story, put in a couple paragraphs about dissent or questioning elsewhere in the administration. I also have to add that despite some of the leaks, it's still difficult to get people in the Bush administration to talk about things like that. There tends to be really heavy punishment for people who not only leak classified information, but for people who say anything except the approved administration, you know, talking points.
Well, you're a Washington journalist. That raises a very interesting question. Obviously, sort of in the first of Bush administration, even further, there was almost an awestruck admiration for the quote-unquote message discipline within the Bush administration, the lack of leaks that had plagued so many other administrations here. Do you find that, frankly, as the Iraq War has proved to be a significant problem, that that climate has eased up a little bit, that it is easier to get contrary information, unflattering information out of the administration, or are they still pretty good about keeping their story straight?
I think what you see is on the outside, when you retire generals, members of Congress, people outside the administration, they're more willing to speak up now. Maybe even occasionally some actually active duty officers are a little bit more willing to speak up. But I have to say, within the administration itself, I'm finding that in some senses the second term is even more difficult than the first term. And the reason for that is in the first term there were policy wars going on between the Pentagon and the White House on one side, and on the other side the State Department and the CIA. And it was usually possible to talk to one side or the other and to get information. In this administration, especially with Condoleezza Rice as Secretary of State, they've imposed even more message discipline.
Is there any possibility in your mind that, frankly, the media might sort of overcompensate for what it clearly saw as a shortcoming in 2002-2003 and be too skeptical of what we end up hearing from our political leadership about the threat from Iran?
You know, that's another excellent question, and I think the answer is possibly yes. And not just the media, but the international community. I have this fear that, you know, Iran actually is a much greater threat than Iraq ever was, but that because of what the Bush administration did in Iraq, it'll be very hard for it to make the case internationally for concerted action. And I'm not just talking about military action. I'm talking about sanctions or whatever it takes to stop them from proceeding with developing a nuclear weapon. So it's really a horrible irony if that were to be the case. Every journalist hates to be called a wimp or a sap, so I think you could very easily see journalists overcompensating, being overly aggressive this time around. But maybe that's not such a bad thing.
Make up for last time anyway. Thanks for joining us today, Warren.
Thanks very much for having me.
Warren Strobel is foreign affairs correspondent for McClatchy Newspapers.
In the 1960s, military analyst Daniel Ellsberg had access to a lot of highly classified information. He worked for the Pentagon, the State Department, and the Rand Corporation. In 1971, he unlocked his safe, made a lot of photocopies, and leaked the Pentagon Papers to the New York Times. In October's edition of Harper's, with a potential war in Iran as his focus, Ellsberg renews his call for insider leaks. Daniel Ellsberg, welcome back to On the Media.
Glad to be here.
So if you had the Pentagon Papers today, what would you do with them? Which senators would you go to, and which reporters at which papers would you go to?
From my own experience, I wouldn't waste time now going only to the Senate, Congress. I wasted really 22 months waiting for Senator Fulbright and others to decide to take the political risk of putting out secrets and doing nothing about it. In effect, they were waiting for me to do it on my own, but they didn't tell me that. What I would do, or what I would advise other people to do right now, is to go at the beginning to the press and the Senate and the Congress in general, and tell the truth with documents, and to do it before the war, not to wait the way I did until years had passed in the war. I would have done it earlier if I'd thought of it, and I just thought of it too late. I'm trying now to remedy that with this Harper's article and with other talks like this one, to suggest to people who have safes in their office to ask themselves, do I have a right to keep this secret? Many people didn't ask themselves that question, and they went ahead and they were silent in Iraq about a war they knew would be disastrous. There are a lot of people right now who know that an attack on Iran would be at least as disastrous, perhaps much more, especially if nuclear weapons are used. And yet, so far, most of them have been silent.
You say in your article that people in your position have to swear a couple of oaths. One is to uphold the Constitution, and the other is to maintain the secrecy that your office and clearance requires.
You know, strictly speaking, one often uses the word oath for a secrecy agreement. Actually, it's a contractual agreement. It's something you sign, usually, which says, I understand that I may be subject to prosecution if I violate this agreement. It's not actually an oath. The oath that you take, every official and every military officer, is to uphold the Constitution. It is not to obey the President of the United States. People in the government do act as though the secrecy agreement, which they colloquially call an oath, takes precedence over any other loyalty. It doesn't occur to you that anything you might be asked to do by the President could possibly be against the Constitution. If public servants understood the reality that a secrecy agreement often conflicts with their oath to uphold the Constitution, I would hope they would realize that that oath to the Constitution takes precedence, and that when the President breaks the laws, it's not right for them to accompany him and to be an accomplice in that.
So today, in regard to the war in Iraq and the potential war in Iran, you want civil servants to act as heroes, choosing allegiance to the Constitution over allegiance to the President. Do you think they know what they signed up for?
You know, it shouldn't have to be regarded as heroic to fulfill your oath to the Constitution when you see it being violated by your superiors. But in fact, it is very, very uncommon. It does take courage to do it. And there will be a price for doing that, whether it involves prosecution or not. But many lives are at stake. This war in Iran, which is described as possibly inevitable by Time magazine this week in the cover story, would not be inevitable and could definitely be stopped by somebody laying out the official estimates of the costs and the consequences and the terrible prospects of such a war. They would show it to be crazy, just as the Iraq War was a crazy decision and the Vietnam War, of which I was part, was a crazy decision in terms of the legality but also the disparity of costs and consequences and any possible benefits. So I'm saying, yes, an individual could have enormous effect, and I hope one or more of them will do that.
Dan, thank you very much.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
You can find Daniel Ellsberg's piece in the current edition of Harper's.
Coming up, journalists just can't have too much access, except perhaps in Iraq, and the semiotics of spinach.
This is On the Media from NPR. This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Mark Jerkowitz. A government commission in Ottawa this week cleared a Canadian citizen of suspected ties to Al-Qaeda in a case that dates back more than 4 years. In September 2002, computer engineer Meir Arar was detained at John F. Kennedy International Airport in New York City by U.S. officials acting on what turned out to be false intelligence from Canadian law enforcement.
The Royal Canadian Mounted Police, or RCMP, believed Arar might be a terrorist based entirely on circumstantial evidence, evidence that the U.S. Justice Department nevertheless found compelling. Arar soon found himself on a plane to Syria in what the U.S. government has called a deportation, but others are calling rendition, the practice of transferring a terrorism suspect to a third-party nation for interrogation.
This launched a series of events that led to the leak of yet more false information and, more significantly, the torture of Mr. Arar. Toronto Globe and Mail columnist Margaret Wente believes that in this case, the media are as guilty as the government. Margaret, welcome to On the Media.
Thank you.
Now, he wasn't held, obviously, in the United States for very long. He was deported to his native Syria over his objections. What happened to him in Syria?
The first couple of weeks, he was tortured, whipped with electric cable, and roughed up pretty badly. And under torture, he made a false confession. After that, he was kept in a little room the size of about, you know, 6 by 6 or something like that for the next 10 months or so.
How were the media treating the story and his presumptive guilt or innocence?
They were asking hard questions about how the Canadians could let the Americans get away with this. Whether this guy is a good guy or a bad guy or whatever he is, why didn't they just send him back to Canada? But I think the jury was kind of out, you know, on Mayor Arar's guilt or innocence, because nobody really knew for sure.
The Canadian government obviously did manage to get him back from the Syrians in late 2003. He gave a press conference then. First of all, what did he say when he came back? And then did that change public reaction toward his case and his role?
He described the details of his torture. He said he confessed to Al-Qaeda ties, but he said, I would have confessed to anything. He described his mental anguish. He described how he had lived in this cell the size of a coffin. And his wife, who had been fighting for him all this time and protesting his innocence, was by his side. People looked at this man and they said, that man is telling the truth. But, of course, for the authorities, this posed a very difficult problem. Because behind the scenes, the Mounties, the RCMP, had told the Americans that this couple were Islamist terrorists with connections to Al-Qaeda. So if Mayor Arar is telling the truth, this means that the Canadian authorities framed, either by design or by incompetence, an innocent man.
Now, I gather that editorial opinion in the Canadian press began to change at this point, but there still seem to have been articles, front-page articles even, continuing to raise suspicions about Mr. Arar, keeping the doubt alive. Was this a matter, as far as you can tell, of law enforcement leaking information to the press to continue to raise doubts about him, and secondarily, the press being too willing to accept that information?
Yes, lots of suggestion that Mayor Arar is not the innocent virgin he claims to be in the quote of one highly placed official. There were maybe half a dozen stories that included this type of innuendo, all attributed to highly placed government officials with knowledge of the case. Some of these people were quoted. They got onto the CBC, CTV, the other national network, a couple of the national papers, including our own to some extent. So there were a lot of doubters out there, and the doubters were allowed to keep on doubting when they read this stuff.
Right now, where's public opinion in Canada? First of all, about Mr. Arar, is he widely seen as a victim or a hero or something in between?
There's been a complete reversal in public opinion. The public inquiry just concluded, and the report was issued this week, 1,200 pages. It did not find that the RCMP knew what the Americans were doing or going to do when they rendered Mr. Arar back to Syria. But it did find that the RCMP fed the Americans false information. The report also dealt with the disinformation campaign and the efforts to smear Mr. Arar in the media, which were, of course, partially successful. But now, Mayor Arar, having been completely vindicated, is now seen as a hero.
You know, in this country in the last couple of years, there's been a lot of soul-searching about the use of anonymous sources and leaked information. In your column about this episode, you quote a professor as saying, the media are too willing to be used. It's time to hold these people accountable. Do you think there have been real lessons learned for the news media in Canada as a result of what's happened here?
I would like to say yes. There are debates now in our paper, for example, over the use of anonymous sources, just the very same kind of debate that the New York Times had with itself. and resolution that we have to come a little bit cleaner with readers, and we also have to hold these anonymous people to account so that we can understand what their agendas are. Because what we did to Mayor Arar was a minor role in his torment, but we're still responsible for some of it.
In the immortal words of former Labor Secretary Ray Donovan, where do I go to get my reputation back? I guess he's asking right now.
That's right.
Margaret, thank you very much.
Thanks. I enjoyed being with you today.
Margaret Wente is a columnist for the Toronto Globe and Mail. After 5 months of trying to work things out with the U.S. military, the Associated Press has finally gone public with its problem. Its Pulitzer Prize-winning photographer, Bilal Hussein, has been held by the U.S. military in Iraq since April without charge. U.S. military officials say Hussein has close relationships with the insurgents. But AP says, go ahead and charge him with something then. Kathleen Carroll is executive editor of the Associated Press. Kathleen, welcome to On the Media.
Thank you, Mark.
Let's start with the very basics of this particular case. Who is Bilal Hussein, and can you describe the circumstances of him being hired by the Associated Press?
Sure. Bilal is a native of Fallujah, Iraq, and a graduate of the Baghdad Institute of Technology. And when our reporters and photographers were traveling around Iraq and doing stories, we hired him as a knowledgeable local person, the term of art fixer, to help us find our way around Fallujah. When it became too difficult for our non-Iraqi Arab and Western staffers to work in Fallujah, particularly as a photographer, Bilal volunteered to be trained, and as we do with many local staffers all over the world, we gave him a tryout. He passed the test. We gave him a lot of training on the equipment and on journalism ethics, vetted him with experienced editors. He worked out very well for us, and so we kept him on.
Let's talk about the specifics of this case. What happened? Where was he when he was detained? Can you give me the circumstances of that day?
Sure. The most detail we have about that comes from the U.S. military, which says that he was in a building with two other people when he was arrested in the morning.
Two other people that the military have characterized as enemy combatants or insurgents. Is that correct?
That's what they've told us, yes. We have been in touch with him, but he says that, you know, he was doing his job as a journalist, which involves talking to all kinds of people and making himself available to talk with them so that he can make pictures of them without endangering himself.
Are you aware to any extent what his relationship with members of the insurgency might be? Do you know, frankly, whether he has just sources within the insurgency or would have any special knowledge about what's going on there?
I would say two things about that, Mark. One, we are not particularly interested in trying to suss out the details and evidence and try Bilal, you know, on your program or any other way in the media. We have always said if there's a problem, put it before a court. That said, we've done our own examination of his work, our relationship with him, all the conversations he's had with all of the AP employees, and found absolutely nothing. Absolutely nothing that would lead us to believe his relationships were anything other than those of a native son committing journalism in his hometown and then later in a town up the road.
How do you describe the sort of the kind of work and the kinds of things he's been doing for AP?
We reviewed 420 photographs, the body of his work as it moved on our circuits. The vast majority of those photographs show the aftermath of combat, show the effects of fighting on buildings, on cars, on people. There are people showing emotion, grief. There are occasionally dead bodies. There are wounded people. 37 of the 420 pictures showed armed men or masked men who could conceivably be insurgents or fighters. And in three or so of those photos, they're actually firing weapons. The distinction that I really want to make that's very important here, Mark, if you believe that someone is tied in with insurgents, you would logically assume that they would be at the scene of insurgent activity fairly early after it happened. You might expect to see pictures of, you know, cars blowing up with giant flames leaping out of them. And that's just not the case in Bilal's work. Our review found that most of the violence had subsided by the time he arrived to make pictures. That's important to us.
According to a May email from a military official to the AP, this is what they've said. He has close relationships with persons known to be responsible for kidnapping, smuggling, improvised explosive attacks, and other attacks on coalition forces. Do you accept that as a possibility? Do you refute that? Or do you just sort of don't have a comment on that per se and are just looking at his work and his work habits?
Well, I can only respond to it generally because there's never been anything specific that comes beyond that. Bilal grew up in Fallujah. I don't know about you, but not all the people that I grew up with turned out exactly well. You know, some of them ended up doing things that that our mothers might not like. I don't know whether that's the case with Bilal because we've never had any names associated with this. Just they think his relationships are unsavory. Any journalist will tell you that occasionally you end up having dinner with or interviewing or taking pictures of somebody that you might not want to have over to the house, but that's a part of your job as being a journalist. How could anybody in Boston, Chicago, New York, or Philadelphia have covered the mob if they didn't get to know all these colorful characters a little bit? Does that mean that they should go to jail without charge because they hang out with guys that have names from The Sopranos? No.
Kathleen, I appreciate your time.
My pleasure, Mark.
Kathleen Carroll is executive editor of the Associated Press.
And now, on to spinach. Poor, poor spinach. As authorities race this week to find the source of the E. coli contamination that has so far sickened more than 150 people, sales of fresh spinach plummeted. Nobody knows how long America's bad associations with spinach will last. Too bad it doesn't have the booster it once had. Popeye was born as a comic strip in 1929 and a few years later was adapted for the screen. The Paramount cartoon was enormously popular and was even credited with saving the spinach industry in the 1930s, a fact that strikes Michael Pollan, who writes about the food industry and food culture, as somewhat odd.
You know, it's very interesting that the spinach people look at Popeye as a savior of their vegetable because, as I recall, as a big Popeye fan, it had the opposite effect on me. Telling people that something was so good for you was a way of saying that it doesn't taste very good. So I did not really discover spinach until I was an adult. And I credit Popeye for slowing down that discovery.
He ate his spinach out of a can. Would that have been the most common consumption method back in the 30s, or would they have eaten it fresh?
That was the prestigious way, you know, to eat vegetables then. You know, a can was considered much more high-tech and modern than eating, you know, something that came out of the field and actually had dirt on it.
Last year, a writer for the magazine Cannabis Culture made the case that Popeye wasn't actually getting his amazing strength from spinach at all, but rather from a different green leaf. Did you see that piece?
I did, indeed.
We call it grass, but back in the 30s...
It was spinach. A slang term for marijuana in the 30s was spinach, and this was perhaps a joke on the part of the writers of Popeye.
And the case was actually made back in the earlier part of the century that marijuana did endow its users with super strength.
That's a very common statement about drugs that you're trying to demonize, that they give scary people superhuman powers. You know, angel dust was, you remember how that people used to talk about angel dust would create these all-powerful maniacs on the street. We have to remember this period we're talking about, the 30s, the drug war had began against marijuana. It had been legal immediately before this period, you know, a bohemian drug of great popularity. And then there was this effort to make it illegal and really demonize it in the culture. So it may be that those early Popeye artists were making their own kind of underground protest.
Of course, the other theory is that spinach was just regarded as super healthy and, in fact, even healthier than it actually is. Apparently, there was a study done by Dr. E. von Wolf in 1870 that, because of a misplaced decimal point, endowed spinach with 10 times the iron that it actually has.
So you're dumping on spinach, too?
I am.
many, many different foods and vegetables have had their moment in the sun in terms of getting, you know, a big push.
Mm-hmm.
And we always focus on the nutrient in it. You know, it's the calcium, it's the iron.
You call this nutritionism, right?
Yeah, there is an ideology at large. And it is this focus on looking at foods as delivery systems for nutrients. And I think that that's, you know, not a very good way to look at them. The key is to keep your eye on the whole food. And in general, we know that dark leafy green vegetables are really good for you. We don't know exactly why. We have our theories. They're often proven wrong. But if you eat food, you're going to be okay. And eating nutrients may not be the wisest way to go.
And of course, you know, a little knowledge is a dangerous thing. We learn about vitamin C and suddenly orange juice is healthy.
You know, the orange is a great case. I mean, the orange got a huge push from its industry. The orange growers of Florida got together and hired Anita Bryant and did this amazingly effective advertising campaign such that every American believes it is an absolute necessity for good health to drink a glass of orange juice every morning. When in fact, the differences in effect on your body of a big tall glass of orange juice and a big tall glass of Coca-Cola are not that great. I mean, you're getting a big hit of sugar and an insulin spike as a result. Yeah, you are getting some nutrients too. You're getting some vitamin C. But eating an orange actually is much better for you because then you get, again, the whole food. You get the fiber with it, which slows down the absorption of the sugar.
So the government has taken great precautions during this dangerous period for spinach. Do you think they did the right thing?
It is interesting that their recommendations about spinach are completely different than what their recommendations have been in the past when hamburger was contaminated with E. coli, the same microbe. In the case of the burgers, they didn't tell us to throw out our hamburger or stop eating hamburgers. They just said, cook them well. Go ahead and eat the E. coli, just kill it first. The government is incredibly solicitous of meat producers always. And, you know, perish the thought that Americans would be told to stop eating hamburgers even for a day. There's just too much power in that beef lobby. And the spinach folks, you know, obviously don't have that kind of clout.
Michael, thank you very much.
You're welcome, Brooke.
Michael Pollan is the author of most recently, The Omnivore's Dilemma, A Natural History of Four Meals.
Spinach has vitamin A, B, and D. But spinach never appealed to me. But one day while having dinner with a guy, I decided to give it a try. I didn't like it the first time, it was so new to me. I didn't like it the first time, I was so young, you see. I used to run away from the stuff, but now somehow I can't get enough. I didn't like it the first time. Oh, how it grew on me.
Up next, find out which presidential hopeful has begun stumping in the virtual world.
This is On the Media from NPR.
Right now I think it's great. Somehow it's always hitting the spot, especially when they bring it in hot.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and the Kresge Foundation, investing in nonprofits to help them catalyze growth, connect to stakeholders, and challenge greater support. On the web at kresge.org. The Wallace Foundation, supporting ideas, sharing solutions, expanding opportunities. On the web at wallacefoundation.org. And the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, committed to helping Americans lead healthier lives and get the care they need. On the web at rwjf.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Mark Jerkowitz. Every day, millions of people leap from their workaday worlds into the magical realms offered online by such multiplayer fantasy games as World of Warcraft and EverQuest. But recently, we've seen the emergence of another online world. This one looks very much like our own and increasingly crosses over into our own. It's called Second Life, launched by Linden Lab, but created largely by the people who build homes there, open businesses there, and party there.
At the moment, there are about 700,000 registered members of Second Life, peanuts compared to World of Warcraft's 7 million. But Second Life isn't a game, its makers say. It's a world, one that is increasingly visited by real-life musicians, activists, and lecturers who address halls full of fanciful-looking avatars representing real people logged into Second Life. Recently, Harvard University announced that it had bought an island there, where it will offer classes to students around the world. Soon, a Democratic presidential hopeful, former Virginia Governor Mark Warner, will convene a town hall meeting in Second Life. That will be his second trip. Last month, he held a press conference there. Mark Warner joins us now. Hello, Governor.
Hey, Brooke, how are you?
Why'd you go into Second Life?
Well, I spent 20 years in the technology business before I got involved in politics. I was one of the two co-founders of Nextel, and then I had a venture capital firm that was all focused on telecom and IT. My sense was, you know, the way people are forming communities, the way people are getting their news, particularly about politics, is changing from the old, let's just watch those dreadful 30-second TV slash and burn ads that have dominated so much of politics over the last 10 or 15 years. We saw the internet start to transform political campaigns in 2004. I think it's going to exponentially transform as we move towards 2008. So the idea of going into Second Life and having my own avatar and a virtual world press conference, it took a little bit of convincing, but it didn't take too much from my internet team to push me into taking the plunge.
Did you have any trouble selecting what your avatar would look like? I mean, how long did it take to develop?
Well, I got to tell you, if I was a really good politician, I'd say I spent hours on it. The folks who work with me put the avatar together. I told them that as long as I was going to be a little bit bold here as being a political figure that was going to go into this virtual world, that they need to make me look as much as possible like at least a fairly boring-looking politician in terms of what the avatar was. And they did. I kind of, you know, looked like a regular, you know, guy with a suit on and a jacket and tie and kind of stiff.
So you go in there to have a press conference and you offer a variety of policy positions. What were some of the ones you covered?
Well, there was some questions about my overall views of kind of the frame of the political debate, which I believe is, you know, going to shift from the traditional left versus right or liberal versus conservative more to a future versus past framework. And obviously, this session with Second Life was a living, breathing example of that. And I also talked about Iraq. I talked about abortion. I mean, I talked about some of the traditional issues. But in the midst of the press conference, I think, you know, one of the avatars started to fly above my head. And, you know, that was a little strange.
A rather chaotic, almost surrealistic landscape that you'd landed in. I gather you got some criticism for submitting yourself to an environment that lacked decorum.
If that was the criteria of how we were operating politics in this country, I'm not sure. You know, I just think about all the events I've been to as governor of Virginia. I'm not sure all of them had appropriate decorum. But if I'm accused of kind of being a little bit more on the cutting edge in terms of how we use new technology, you know, I'll take that criticism.
This is quite a community. It's a community that talks to itself. It's a wired community. So I guess you could see it as a portal into that vast internet space that many political strategists are making a great deal of these days.
Absolutely. People are forming all kinds of different communities online. They are sharing their views. Many folks who are online don't trust traditional media. And, you know, I'm willing to, you know, within certain bounds, talk to all these folks any way I possibly can. I know when I got some of this criticism about, well, isn't this a little strange to go into the Second Life? I kind of remembered back to the early 80s when I got into the cellular telephone industry and So many of my friends who are traditional business guys would say, you know, Warner, you're crazy. Nobody's ever going to want a cell phone.
And I understand that you're going back into Second Life a little bit later this month. That forum is going to be something of a town hall. You're more likely to have more flyers and people whose avatars are geckos.
If I thought this one was a little surreal, I'm not sure how the next one will be. I can only imagine I'll probably get slightly more bizarre, slightly more technocratic questions at the next town hall. I imagine I'll get some questions about BitTorrents. I imagine I'll get some questions about different ways that information is distributed over the net.
Have you heard about any other candidates who wanted to follow your footsteps into the virtual world?
I think they were probably deciding, you know, whether they wanted to throw stones at me for kind of going into this second world or saying, darn, I wish we would have gotten there first. But, you know, my sense is that others will follow. You know, I think that's healthy. The internet ought to be a place where there's a free flow of ideas and debate. And you know what I'd say to any of the other potential candidates? Yeah, come on in. The virtual world water is fine.
And if you were elected president, would you have jurisdiction over Second Life?
Well, maybe I wouldn't, but my avatar might. Now, that would be interesting to have the battle between the elected embodied candidate and then the virtual candidate. And if at times at some point they actually had policy differences, I'm not sure how we'd work through that one. You know, stay tuned.
Thank you so much, Governor.
All right, Brooke. Thank you.
Former Virginia Governor Mark Warner. At the dawn of its creation, Second Life was a vast virtual prairie studded with mountains and lakes, home to a rugged few.
It was very much like when Native Americans were roaming the country, and it was relatively Arcadian.
James Au is a reporter in the real world, hired by Linden Lab back in early 2003, when the game was still in the experimental or beta stage, as its first embedded reporter. Au watched as the swelling population transformed the landscape and in the process transformed Arcadia into America.
Because what happened immediately after the beta period was a group that came from another game called World War II Online discovered Second Life, and they jumped into it en masse. Over 100 of them came in, and they started building tanks and fortresses and shooting people. And they actually took over an area that was meant to be a free fire zone, but the original Second Life settlers were kind of living there peacefully, and so they just jammed into this free fire zone area, and they started killing the original natives. And so that became a big battle.
Second Life continued to relive American history with a revolution. Linden Lab was charging people for the things they built to fill the empty spaces of their world, because all that digital construction was overloading their servers.
So what they did is put a tax on that, and you'd have Linden dollars deducted from your account. But what happened was there was a group called Americana, and they were creating an area that would be tribute to American icons like the Washington Monument, Fenway Park. And this was meant as a public works project, but they were getting taxed up the wazoo because it took a lot of objects to create this, a lot of building blocks. And finally, they say, look, because they're an Americana group, they launched a tax revolt. And their leader was this cat, Fleabite Beach. And Fleabite Beach sent out a Henry David Thoreau declaration against Mad King Linden. And they covered the whole Americana area with giant tea crates. And they set the Route 66 driveway on fire.
Soon after, Linden Lab ended the tax system, ushering in an era of unbridled commerce fueled by Linden dollars, purchasable by credit card at the current rate of 300 to the U.S. dollar. Now, instead of taxes, people pay Linden Lab for the land they buy, spruce it up with new content like buildings and trees, rent it for virtual money that they can then trade in for cold, hard cash.
There's a woman named Anshe Chung, and she makes an estimated $150,000 a year and owns a whole continent. And she's actually set up a shop of content creators in China to outsource 3D development.
With its population growing by more than 25% a month, Second Life is an increasingly popular world, but some locations are more popular than others, hence the land boom. It's also a very social world. People go to a lot of parties and they want to be all that they can be, or someone they can't otherwise be. So there's a design boom, too.
The top fashion designers make upwards of $70,000 a year. That's people who create fashions for avatars, clothes, shoes, also hair. Hair extensions are really popular. Jewelry, what are called skins, which is kind of like a full body tattoo.
Jane McGonigal is an expert in the field of participatory gaming and what's called immersive play.
The most interesting thing about Second Life is how intrigued its residents are by playing with the line between the virtual life or Second Life and their real lives, or what they call their first lives. You know, you've got mixed reality parties.
That's when you go to a real life party and the Second Life version is projected on a wall.
So you can see people you know who aren't in the same city, who are in a virtual version of the room that you are in having an actual party.
A real life musician even staged a virtual concert in Second Life.
Hello out there. Hello in here. This event is the first time a major recording artist has performed live in avatar form. And without further ado, Suzanne Vega.
But it's not all fun and games, Jane McGonigal.
And you have real-world psychologists who have set up shop in Second Life who are offering mental health services to people who, in their real lives, have mental health needs.
James Au has even written about Second Life detective agencies, which specialize in catching virtual adulterers.
The detective will set up a sting operation, a honey trap, where they'll put a hot male or female babe into the setting with the client's suspected unfaithful partner and see if they take the bait.
But as you pointed out in your story, when the hot babe sting operation takes place, almost every single male avatar folds like a house of cards within seconds.
Yeah. So there's a lot of it going on.
Second Life is so much like real life, it even harbors real life anxiety about addictive, antisocial, productivity shriveling video games. Science and technology writer Clive Thompson.
I actually wrote a story a while ago about an Australian inside the game who created a little video game called Tringo, and it's sort of a mix of bingo and Tetris. It's a lot of fun. It's enormously fun.
So the Australian invited Second Life pals over to a Second Life place to try the game and buy it and take it back to their virtual apartments to play. He sold enough of them to earn about 4,000 real dollars. Tringo became so popular, in fact, that it became a threat.
Yeah, because Second Life is not really a game, because it is a social environment, there's a lot of emphasis put on the socializing, on the talking, on the making stuff, on the hosting of parties, on the visiting other people, on being creative. And so suddenly people were logging into Second Life just to go and sort of sit in front of a Tringo game with a dozen other people sort of playing Tringo. So the thing that people were saying about it was that this game is ruining the quality of life inside Second Life. And this cracked me up because, of course, it was people complaining that a game was ruining life inside a game.
I asked Clive to take me in.
Here we go, logging in.
I chose a name, an avatar. It's kind of cool picking a whole new look. And he sent me sailing over the landscape of Second Life.
Now, here you are. There you are in your outfit. You've got sort of nice little sort of dirty jeans on.
I look pretty hot, I have to admit.
Yeah, you look great. Here's something fun. I'll just show you. Here we can fly.
Whoa! We land where some people are milling around, and suddenly a song comes up. Master and Slave Toy Store.
Yeah,
that's where we are.
Yeah,
gee, thanks
see.
For taking me here, Clive.
No problem. Yeah, I aim to please.
There's a guy. Let's go up to him. Ask whether he comes here often.
Yeah, sure.
Heya. I didn't ask you to say heya.
Nice way to start a conversation.
Greetings, lady. Ask, are they in the market for something? Alan Taney said, to find somebody interested by spankings. I don't think he's really an English speaker.
All right, well, we'll just head out.
Now, they say the more you go in, the more friends you make, the richer the experience in Second Life, where activities range from getting and spending and building and selling to flirting to flying to inventing stuff to self-invention and to spanking, I suppose. But I asked Clive, why bother when you can do all that stuff in the real world?
Yeah, that's true. The difference is that Second Life is a lot more beautiful than the real world.
on a flat screen made of pixels with pixelated people. I mean, how persuasive is that kind of beauty?
Well, it's pretty persuasive if you live, you know, in an industrial park in Ohio. A lot of people inside these games live in incredibly boring places, locked into incredibly boring jobs. You have to ask yourself, which is fundamentally a more fun reality?
There's definitely a sense that you have a little more creative control and personal power in Second Life.
Jane McGonigal.
I mean, the question is, do gamers and residents of virtual worlds want to role play or do they want to real play? Anytime you talk to a World of Warcraft player, they talk about it as a way of escaping the regular life. And you don't really hear that from residents of Second Life. It's very much an integral part of their identity and their lives.
I want to go play in somebody else's world.
Edward Castronova writes about the economics of online games. He says that the profit motive built into Second Life tracks pretty much with reality. That's why he doesn't spend too much time there. He prefers fantasy games like EverQuest, where, unlike Second Life and the real world, you don't set your own goals. Your tasks, whether grand or mundane, as, say, carrying some gold to the next village, are all designed for you and all important in that world.
The fantasy worlds, they focus not on commerce per se, although there's plenty of commerce, but I think what really attracts people to them is the map of meaning. The fantasy that creates good and evil and puts significance behind what people are doing. Every time you do something in one of the fantasy virtual worlds, you are told that you matter. And that is something missing from the real world economy.
In his free time, he prefers his meaning ready-made. That's more fun. Fun is fundamental to all virtual worlds. And this, says Castronova, has policy implications for the real world.
Let's look at this Iraq war as a game designer would. Let's say we're making a part of the game environment of our people, and we want them to be happier. And then you might think, gosh, that's why Iraq 1 was more fun than Iraq 2. Iraq 1 had a victory condition. You know, it was limited in time. It didn't go on forever, and so on and so forth. And I'm not suggesting that we really should do policy this way right now. What I'm suggesting is that over the next 100 years, as more and more people grow up familiar with game design as a part of their policy environment within these games, we will see increasing pressure and new insights in real-world policy where people go, now is that the funnest inflation rate that they could have designed? Don't we want a more fun one than that? And we're going to have to deal with this.
What he's saying is you may not get the world online, but sooner or later that world is going to get you. You'll see game thinking play out in tax policy. You'll see it in education. You may even see it in war planning. We like to play, and politics is the biggest game of all. Maybe that's why Mark Warner, an early adopter, jumped into Second Life so soon.
And you know what I'd say to any of the other potential candidates? Yeah, come on in. The virtual world water is fine.
And the shopping's even better. You can even buy a whole new face, which could come in handy if you're running for office.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Megan Ryan, Tony Field, Jamie York, and Mike Vuolo, and edited by Brooke. Dylan Keefe is our technical director, and Jennifer Munson, our engineer. We had help from Alicia Rebensdorf. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer, and John Keefe, our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. You can listen to the program and find free transcripts, MP3 downloads, and our podcast at onthemedia.org, and email us at onthemedia@wnyc.org. This is On the Media from WNYC. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Mark Jerkowitz. Bob Garfield will be back next week.
On the Media is supported by Ciaobella Gelato, purveyors of all natural gelato and sorbet. Ciaobella is available nationwide at specialty food markets. More information at ciaobellagelato.com or 1-800-GELATO-3. Support for On the Media also comes from the Bidell Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the John and Anna Maria Phillips Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.
Thanks for checking out this week's On the Media from WNYC, New York Public Radio. Support your local public radio station. Visit onthemedia.org to find where On the Media is playing near you. And please help support this free service by becoming a member of WNYC at wnyc.org. And thanks.